better answer to now, which was about how do we know that p is not equal to x? So this is called the time hierarchy theorem. And I mean, I just glanced at the proof, so I'm not prepared to do it in detail. In any case, it might take a little long. But well, basically, it is, in fact, the diagonalization argument. So in fact, it shows something stronger. It shows that if you look at the class of problems that's decidable in time f of n on a Turing machine, then, for instance, the class that's decidable on time f of n squared is actually different. It has some problems that are in one but not the other. And of course, this is not robust to different definitions of, you know, you have a Turing machine with two tapes or some other kind of machine. But in particular, it's enough to show that polynomial time is different from exponential time. Okay, and the way it works is, you write a Turing machine which takes two inputs, and one of them is the description of a Turing machine that takes time, say, f of n to decide a problem. The other is the input to the problem. So this machine can run in time f of n squared, you know, for in the right type of simulation. So basically, it's simulating another Turing machine on this particular input. But the problem is, it takes longer to do that than the original one because it has to, you know, go through all the steps of the first one. And actually, you can show this that it has to take longer than f of n through a diagonalization argument, where you basically make a yet a slightly different Turing machine that takes the description of machine and runs it on itself as input. So runs it on its own program code and then gives the opposite result. So if the first one says yes, then this one says no, and the first one says no, running on its own program code, then this one says yes. And you can show that can't stop because it would be kind of a contradiction, right? Is that it would run it on its own program code, and then if it happened to be in time f of n, then you could do that, right? But then it would be contradicting itself on the output. Okay, so that's roughly how it goes. Yeah.
Sorry. I just want to follow up. So the basic argument is, you take a machine that can simulate any machine that can solve a certain problem in f of n,
right?
F of n,
right?
And then you say that machine can't possibly simulate itself because of diagonalization.
Yeah, roughly speaking.
Okay, and that means that if it could solve that problem in O of f of n, it would have to be able to simulate itself. So.
Right, okay. Right. And so actually, I just looked on Wikipedia. So there's a proof in Wikipedia. Actually, with f of n cubed. But so time hierarchy theorem. Okay. So how was the tutorial yesterday? Good. Okay. Okay. Well, Euclid's algorithm is a classical algorithm, so in that sense, it's not really essential for the class. But it's a very nice algorithm, and it's useful for various things. In fact, I'll be using it today, at least once, maybe twice. Are there any other questions? No? Okay. So then let's get started on Shor's algorithm. So Shor's algorithm is for factoring large numbers. So first let me, oh, I didn't move the board here. So first let me explain why what the factoring numbers problem is. That's straightforward, and why it's an interesting problem. So factoring, well, you have n, which is a product of p and q. And we're going to, in fact, you can restrict attention to the case where n is a product of two prime numbers. So it's not a general composite number. And our goal is to find p and q. Okay. And maybe just to put this, oh, and so the input size here is the number of bits you need to specify n, not n. So the input size is log n, which maybe I'll sometimes refer to as little. Well, actually, I'm going to use little n for something else. So is log n. So what we'd like to find an efficient factoring algorithm is something that's polynomial in log n. OK? And the reason for this is that, well, multiplying p and q to get n, well, that really does take time, poly log n. Right? And if you use, for instance, long multiplication, that's time n squared. But actually, there's fast multiplication algorithms that do even better than that. But going the other way, factoring, that seems to be a hard problem on a classical computer anyway. But as we'll see, it's not so hard on a quantum computer. OK, so maybe it's worth making a brief aside to say how this problem fits into the decision problem context that we were talking about before. So here's the decision problem version. So given n and some other number, say r, I don't want to use r. Use little m, okay. Does n have a non-trivial factor less than m? Okay, and you can see that if you can solve this problem, this decision problem, then you can quickly solve the factoring problem, right? Because you can say, well, let's start with m equals n over 2. Is there a factor less than that? Well, if there's a factor at all, then there must be a factor less than m over 2. So let's start with m equals square root of n, right? If there's a factor less than that, then we know it's not prime. And so then we can look at, say, square root of n over 2. Is there a factor less than that? If yes, then we narrow it down from there. If no, then we say, well, is there a factor less than 3/4 square root of n? Right? And so you have, you know, you start, well, here's 1, here's square root of n, and you divide and conquer. You say, well, is there one less than here? If not, then we'll look in this interval. And if there is, then maybe we'll look in this interval, right? And you can keep on narrowing it down like that until after only about log n steps, you've narrowed it down to just one number. And you say, below that, there's no factor. There is a factor. Or with one more, there is a factor. So therefore, we know the factor. Okay. And of course, once you have a factor, that's pretty easy to check. Division is worse than multiplication, but not that much worse. It's still polynomial time. OK? So I'm just going to treat this version of the problem. But you can see that up to log factors, it's, well, I guess in this case, polynomial factors, it's basically the same problem. OK? Okay, so why is this an interesting problem? Well, I mean, if you're interested in number theory, it's certainly an interesting problem. But it turns out that it also has a great practical importance. And the reason for that is the factoring problem is the basis of one of the most widely used encryption systems in the world, called RSA. So RSA is named after its inventors, Rivest, Schmier, and Edelman. And RSA is what's known as a public key crypto system. So what that means is Alice and Bob, well, let's say Bob wants to send a secret message to Alice. And he doesn't want an eavesdropper listening in. So he wants to encrypt it, right? So one, the kind of the old-fashioned way to do this is Alice and Bob will share a secret key, okay? And then using the secret key, Bob can encrypt his message, and Alice can decrypt it. And Eve doesn't know the secret key, so she can't read it. In public key crypto system, it works a little bit differently. Alice has a private key that she used to decrypt, and there's also a public key. And the thing about the public key is that everyone can have it. Bob can have it, Charlie can have it, Eve can have it, even, the eavesdropper. Okay? And the public key is used to encrypt. And then the private key is used to decrypt. And only Alice has the private key. Okay? So the advantages of this type of system is that, well, with a private key crypto system, only, or a symmetric crypto system, only Alice and Bob will share the same key. And it's important that only they have it, right? Because if anybody else has it, then that person will be able to read the messages between them. But in this case, only Alice knows how to read her own messages. So this public key that lets Bob encrypt, she can give it to everybody. She can post it on the internet. You can put in your signature. And if you see, you know, PGP signatures, that's a public key. Okay? And there's a whole cryptographic infrastructure built around the idea of these public key crypto systems. I might say a little bit more about that next week when I talk about quantum cryptography. But for now, let's just say this is a very widely used, RSA is in particular, is an example of public key crypto system. It's very widely used. If you've gone to a secure web page, you've almost certainly used RSA to, well, your computer anyway has used it to start that encryption. So, okay, so how does RSA work? So in RSA, the public key is N, which is going to be the N in factoring, and some other number E, which is less than N. And then the private key is just some other number D. And the point is D is derived from the factors of n. Okay, and so that means that when you create this private key public key pair, which Alice has to do, of course, because she's the only one who should get the private key. So Alice wants to generate this pair of keys. So what she does is she takes two large prime numbers and multiplies them together to get n, and picks e appropriately, and then she can figure out what d ought to be in a way I'll describe in a minute. Okay, but someone else coming from the other end, well, they're not going to know p and q. And they'll get n, because that's part of the public key, so that anyone can get that. But if they can't factor, they can't learn p and q. Okay. D is the decryption key, the private key.
Oh, I see.
I haven't defined exactly what these things are yet. I mean, except for N. Okay. So so in particular, here's how encryption works. So Bob is going to take the message that he wants to encrypt, and let's call that X, And so then he encodes it as x to the e mod n. And we'll call this ciphertext that he gets y. Okay? So you take x to the e, so you write x as some number, you know, less than or equal to n. If it's bigger than n, we can chop it up into blocks that are each less than n. So it's you take some number, x, and you raise it to the power e, and then you take the remainder modulo n. Okay? And then decryption. Well, decryption works almost the same way. Alice receives y, and he raises it to the dth power mod n. Okay? And the property of e and d is such that x to the ed is always equal to x mod n. Right? So this is then going to be equal to x again. If she's received a correctly encrypted message. So technically, this is a permutation, this map. So everything she receives can decrypt to something. Right? Obviously, you can raise it to the dth power and get something. But it just might be nonsense. OK? So obviously, there's a couple of points to make here. So one of them is the question, well, how does Alice create this ED pair so that she knows that they have this property? And if she can do it, why can't somebody else? Okay. So of course, the answer is that to do it, Alice is going to have to use the factors, P and Q. Basically, we make use of one of these nice number theoretic theorems. It's a very beautiful one called Euler's theorem. And Euler's theorem says that for any x, and for any n, actually, x to the phi of n is congruent to 1 mod n. OK, where phi of n is the number of numbers, number of positive integers, I guess counting one, which are less than n and relatively prime. Okay, so if n is a prime, then everything less than, so if n is a prime p, then everything less than n is relatively prime to it. So phi of n would then be n minus 1. And what you get out of that is a special case called Fermat's little theorem, which says that x to the p is congruent to x mod p for prime p. But for composite numbers, there's Euler's theorem. And you can work it out. When n is the product of p and q, that means that phi of n is equal to p minus 1 times q minus 1. Okay. So this is obviously getting us closer to what we want, right? Because we then, if we know p and q, we can calculate phi of n. And then we at least know what we want e and d to multiply together to get. Right? So in particular, we want e times d minus 1 to be some multiple of phi of n. OK? So what we're going to do is we're going to pick e and phi of n to be relatively prime. And that's important, actually, because otherwise you cycle too soon, kind of. And this won't be possible, in fact. And then we look at this formula. So here's where Euclid's algorithm comes in. So if you have Euclid's algorithm, I mean, if I don't, I guess not all of you did that problem yesterday, but if you at least looked at the statement, Euclid's algorithm says that, actually, maybe I didn't neatly summarize it. Anyway, Euclid's algorithm says that if you have two numbers A and B, then there exists, actually, maybe it's better to use this, X and Y here. And there exist A and B such that AX plus BY is equal to the greatest common divisor of X and Y. Okay? And moreover, you can find A and B efficiently. Okay? So it's, I mean, originally it's an algorithm for finding the GCD. In this case, we know the GCD is 1. Moreover, it lets you find these coefficients. Okay? And that's relevant here because what we want is this particular coefficient. Right? This one we get 2, but that's not really essential. Okay? And then by finding D using Euclid's algorithm, then we get this public key, private key pair. Okay? But to do this, we need to know what phi of n was, of course. And to do that, we need to know what the prime factorization is. Now, it's possible that there's some other way to break RSA that doesn't involve factoring n. So we don't have a strict proof that in order to that if you can break RSA, then you can factor n. But I think it's generally believed that, that in fact, that is true. That RSA is as hard as factor.
Phi n minus k.
Times k. I don't know if that helps. The point is that if we raise it to the power of 5n, we get 1. If we raise it again to the 5n, so it's 2 5n, then we get 1 again. Right, and so we can raise it as many times as we want to 5n. And then we keep on getting back to where we started. Right? And then, so e times d is 1 more than that. So then we raise it one more time, and we get back x. Okay. Are there any other questions? Okay. So of course, RSA is a widely used crypto system. If you can factor, you can break it. So people have put lots and lots of effort into seeing if they could come up with good factoring algorithms. And indeed, they have. So the obvious way to factor is to say, well, I'll just start trying prime numbers. I'll see if n is divisible by 2, if it's divisible by 3, if it's divisible by 5. You can skip 4, right? Because if it's not divisible by 2, it's certainly not divisible by 4. And so on. You just go up the primes, 7, 11, 13, et cetera. And eventually, once you get to square root of n, if n is composite number, you'll have to find a prime factor. Okay? But the problem is square root of n is a pretty big thing, right? So the input size is log n. And so square root of n is going to be exponential in that. Well, you know, super polynomial anyway. Anyway, people have come up with, no, I guess technically it's exponential, right? Because it's log at 2 to the, you know, 1 half log n. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, in quotes,
this is
like Fogel, or you're just using.
Sorry, say again.
The equal sign, is it congruent?
This one?
No, the one of the. Is it congruent?
This. Oh, yeah, congruent. Congruent mod act. Yeah, you'll find both notations. Sometimes you'll you're talking about this one. Yeah, that's common too. But either way. Other questions? Okay, so So people have found much better factoring algorithms than the naive one of just drawing all prime numbers. And in fact, we can factor quite large numbers, but it still takes exponential time. And so in RSA, to run RSA, you need to do these modular exponentiations. That takes time. I'll talk about that in a moment, actually. That takes time. That's polynomial in log n. So the person doing the encryption, or people running the crypto system, I guess it's really Alice who controls how big the number is, have an advantage over people trying to break them, right? Because if the time to break it is super polynomial, then Alice can just go to a larger and larger key, and her and the encryption and decryption for the honest people only take time that's polynomial in log n. So the amount of time they have to spend increases, but the amount of time that the eavesdropper has to spend to break it increases much more. Okay? Yeah.
Safer or more dangerous if Alice keeps changing the key? Like if she keeps the same questions.
Right. So it's generally safer. It depends on the whole context. So the issue is that to change the key, she needs to distribute a new public key.
Right.
Okay, and so it depends how she's distributing the public key, whether that's safe. If she has a very secure way of distributing it, then it's always safer to change the key. Okay, in practice, the way these public keys are distributed is again using a version of RSA that's used for something called digital signatures, which has there's a whole story that goes into this. In general, I would say it's safer. One thing it doesn't do, though, is protect you against somebody breaking the key and your old key and decrypting your old messages. The thing about RSA is that the eavesdropper can encrypt all the messages she likes to look at practice messages.
Oh, right.
That's in general, public key crypto systems are less strong than private key symmetric ones, partly for this reason, partly because they need more structure. Yeah?
Why does it matter how safely you can get the public key?
Sorry. So the problem is that if Eve manages to substitute one of her own public keys for Alice's public key, then Bob doesn't know that he's encrypting with Eve's key instead of Alice's key, and so he's actually encrypting message that only Eve can. Okay, so that's the reason. Yeah.
So for practical purposes, how big are these numbers?
So I don't actually remember offhand what the record of breaking. RSA. So factoring is maybe on the order of 400 or 500 bits has been broken. People generally say if you use 1,000 bit keys, that should be secure for the foreseeable future, which is unfortunately not very long. So that's the thing about these public key crypto systems, and really about any kind of classical crypto system that depends on some computational problem being hard, is it could be that tomorrow someone will discover a great classical factoring algorithm. I mean, it's possible that the NSA already has one. NSA is the US National Security Agency, is in charge of cryptography, basically, for the US government. And of course, they wouldn't release it if they had it, because they would like to read every terrorist email. And so then if that happened, then anyone who happened to have saved all your past messages could read it. And of course, if they didn't tell you that they had broken it, they could continue to break your future messages as well. So that's one of the motivations for quantum cryptography, which I'll talk about next week. But most people think that there's no particular reason to expect a huge breakthrough in factoring. And so at least for the next few years, 1,000 bit keys are probably OK. Maybe 2,000 bit if you really want to be safe. OK? Yeah?
How is the E transmitted to Alice?
Because so E is part of the public key. So N and E have to be transmitted from Alice to Bob.
So anybody can know about
N and E. Anybody can know N and E. And so Alice creates this pair, D and N and E. So Alice knows D from the start. So nobody has to tell her that. She generates it herself. Or her computer generates it. So it's the question of how you distribute N and E. And there's various options for that. I don't want to go into the whole kind of public key infrastructure that's built up. But like I said, you can put it in the signature of your emails. You can post it on the web. You can tell your friends and ask them to tell their friends what your public key is. Things like that. Okay. Okay. So. So one of the tricks that's been used to factor large numbers is to reduce it to finding the order of a number mod n. So in particular, we have some number x, and x is less than n. And we want to find R, in particular, we want to find the minimal R, such that x to the R is equal to 1 mod n. Right? So this is kind of related to finding this phi of n. It's not exactly the same, because for some particular values of x, it might be smaller. Whereas for for some particular values of x, it could be any kind of factor of phi of n. But for in general, you know that once you raise to the phi of n power, you get back to 1, but it won't necessarily be the smallest phi. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So that maybe gives you some sense. Yeah.
But if that is 0, you don't need to be true.
Minimal r greater than 0. Of course. And of course, if you allow negative numbers, then it could be arbitrary. So you want a non-trivial positive r. So you can see already that it has some connections to the factorization, right? Because phi of n is involved in factorization. But it requires a little more work to actually get the factorization once you know R. But in fact, it works. So what we want to do is we might want to find R in general. So not just for some specific x, but for some kind of arbitrary x. And that will let us factor n. So how does that work? Well, our first goal is to find some y with y squared is equal to 1 mod n. Okay? And when this is the case, then, y squared minus 1, which is y plus 1 times y minus 1, is 0 mod n. So it's some multiple of n. And then n, of course, is p times q. So these factors p and q must be inside one or the other of these two things, right? They could be both together, but in that case, n divides y plus 1 or y minus 1. And what that would mean is that y would be either 1 mod n or minus 1 mod n. So if y is not equal to that, then it follows that p divides y plus 1 and q divides y minus 1, or the other way around. Right? There's no, doesn't say which is p and which is q. OK? And And if this is the case, then we can find GCD of, sorry, of P and Y plus 1. No, that's not right. Sorry, of N and Y plus 1. And the GCD of N and Y minus 1. And N, say N is P times Q, right? If P divides Y plus 1 and Q doesn't divide Y plus 1, which it can't because of this, then this will give us P, and this will give us Q. Yeah, actually, I think only one of these has to give you, because it could be that it's, the other one is big. But basically, this will give you at least one factor, and then you can divide it and get the other one. Okay? So if we can find y that has y squared is equal to 1, then we're done. So to do that, well, if we find x, we not only need this, but we need that y is not equal to plus or minus 1 mod n. But if we find x with even order, so r over 2, then we found r. R over 2 is an integer. Okay? So that means that if we let y equal x to the r over 2, then y squared is equal to 1 mod n. And moreover, since r is the order, we know that y is not equal to 1 mod n. Right? Because then the order would have actually been r over 2, or less. Okay. But it's possible that y could be equal to minus 1 mod n. Nevertheless, it turns out, if we choose a random x, then with some constant probability, constant independent of n, x has even order, and x to the r over 2 is not equal to minus 1 mod n. So that requires some number theoretic proof, which I won't go into. But the upshot is that it's enough to choose a random x, find its order, and you know some constant fraction of the time, I think roughly a half, you'll get an even order, and when you take it to the power over 2, you won't get minus 1. And that will let you do this and find the factors. Okay? Yeah.
What constant right, is it for those that we need it to be bigger than some? Right, is it something that constant with respect to the length of the number?
Yeah.
Okay.
Constant relative to log n. So, yeah, let's say it's a half. It's not exactly half, but I think it's probably half. Okay. So the first time we do it, it might not work. Second time, it might not work. Third time, it might not work. But the odds it doesn't work any of those times is starting to get pretty small, right? If it's about 1/2, then it's about 1/8 that it doesn't work any of those times. And by trying, you know, s times, then we can decrease the probability exponentially with s. Decrease the probability of failure exponentially with s. Yeah?
If we choose what, like, then is it a third line or this?
Sorry, this one?
Third line. 1, 2, 3 lines, third line. If y
this
one. Yeah. Can we not consider a case where both P and Q divides either y plus 1 or y minus 1? Why are these like?
The point is that in this case, it's possible that what we want is we want P to divide one of these and Q to divide the other one. It's possible that one of them doesn't have either P or Q go into it.
Yeah.
And they both go into the other one. And that's what we want to avoid. Okay. I mean, I guess it's still possible that you could have that y is equal to minus 1 mod n, but you know p still divides y minus 1. That's possible. But we can't guarantee that that's going to happen. And in general, the problem is that factoring you know, these numbers is also hard. Right? So we don't want to have to factor them. We want to be able to use something simpler like the GCD, which we can find using Euclid's algorithm. Okay. And to do that, we really need to know that the factors are separate. Okay? Okay. So now, in the last 15 minutes of class, I can get to a quantum algorithm, which is a simplified version of Shor's algorithm. So what Shor's algorithm actually does it factors, but the way it factors is by finding the order. OK, so the basic circuit that we're going to use looks like this. So what we do is we start off with all zeros, and then we do the Hadamard transform. And so this, remember, is going to get a superposition of all numbers, and you know, in the appropriate range. And then we, and so this is going to be, so at this point, we're going to call this superposition of A, for all A in the appropriate range. And then here we put in some more zeros. And now we calculate x to the a in this new register. OK? So at this point, the state we have is sum over a, x to the a. X is the specific number that we're trying to find the order of. So it's fixed. OK? So this is an entangled state between these two registers. And then what we can do is we can measure here. To get some value of y, which is x to the a. But we haven't by doing that, we haven't completely collapsed the state up here. OK? And then we're going to do the Fourier transform. And then measure. OK, so so this part so far is relatively straightforward. And the real interesting quantum part comes in here. So how does that work? Well, let's simplify first to the case. Well, OK, so let me hold off for a second. So when we do this measurement, what we do is we're collapsing to not completely an a, but we're collapsing to all values of a that satisfy this equation, y is equal to x to the a. And of course, the exact value of y that we get is random, right? It's a quantum measurement. But we know that there's a relationship between the different a's that give you this y. And I should say this is mod n. This is modular exponentiation. So we're taking x to the a mod n. Different x's that all have x to the a is equal to y mod n are related. And how are they related? They're related by the order r. So in other words, if x to the a0 is equal to y mod n, then so is x to the a0 plus r And in general, x to the a0 plus, what am I using? J times r. Right? And in fact, these are the only things. You can see that because r is the minimal value for which we get this back. Right? Because if we had x to the a0 plus something less than r, well, then you could divide by x to the a0, and you'd get this something less than r. X to that value would give you 1. OK? And that would equal x to the minus a0 y mod n. And of course, this is y mod n, or y inverse mod n. So this would equal to 1 mod n. I mean, I don't know how familiar you guys are with modular arithmetic. But basically, you can take inverses and stuff like that as long as the numbers you're dealing with are relatively prime to n. And I guess it's worth saying that if somehow you stumble across, in this algorithm anyway, you stumble across a number that's not relatively prime to n, well, then you can short circuit things. Because you can take the GCD. Suppose x, you happen to pick an x that's not relatively prime to n. Then you can take the GCD of x and n and get a factor. Okay. So actually, when you do this, the first thing you should do when you choose a random x is test whether it's relatively prime to n. And if not, then you happen to get lucky. But because n is a product of two very big primes, that's not very likely to happen. OK. So so these are the only values, then, that let you get y. So what the state that we have here, the state that we have at this point is going to be the sum over j now of a0 plus jr. And I guess the second register will always be y. Okay? So now we can ignore the second register. And the point is, this state, well, what does it look like? So if we were to plot the amplitude, well, so there's some value a0, and we have a spike there. Right? And then at a0 plus r, we have another spike. And a0 plus 2r, another spike, and so on. And this thing is periodic. Actually, it's just almost periodic because, well, the range that we're dealing with is not the same as n, necessarily. But this is why we want to apply the Fourier transform. Because the Fourier transform, so the problem with this state, dealing with it directly, is if you just measure it, well, you'll get some particular value of j, right? But you don't know what a0 is either. A0 is random too. So you just get a spike somewhere. And that's not very illuminating. But what we'd like to do is we'd like to extract this period. That's what tells us r. Okay, and the Fourier transform is good at that kind of thing, right? It takes something, some periodic function, and it tells you what the period is. So that's why I want to do the Fourier transform. So in particular,
so x is like another input that classically controls the gate x to the end?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Basically, we pick x and we can design a set of gates that uses x.
Okay. right.
Okay. Any other questions so far? Okay. So the Fourier transform. We want the Fourier transform mod n. But we don't know how to do that. Instead, we'll take the Fourier transform mod 2 to the n, little n. And it turns out, well, we're going to need to choose little n to be substantially larger than n. But as a warm-up, let's imagine that R divides 2 to the n, okay? And the reason I want to do that is that when this is true, if R divides 2 to the n, then this state is perfectly periodic, right? Because you keep on adding R and R and R, and eventually you get back to where you started. Exactly. Okay? Okay, so in that case, the Fourier transform is going to tell us exactly what we want. So the Fourier transform, what it does is it takes, here, I guess we can write it as f here. So it takes some value a, and it gives us sum over b, omega to the ab, b, where omega is a 2 to the nth root of unity. OK? This is a discrete Fourier transform.
Yeah. Just how do we fit? The only R that would divide just to the n, though, would be itself a power.
Yeah. This is a characterization.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. This is not an interesting case. I mean, it's possible that R could be a power of 2, but not for most interesting n's. This is just a warm-up. OK, so if this is the case, that R divides to the n, then the state we have when we apply the Fourier transform, well, what do we get? Well, we get sum over b, sum over j, of omega to the a0 plus jr times b. And if we organize this correctly, we can factor out this omega to the a0b, right? So a0 is not gone, but it just becomes a phase. And then we have sum over j of omega to the jrb, b, OK? And let's look at this thing. Well, in the case where r divides 2 to the n, omega, remember, is e to the 2 pi I over 2 to the n. So this is e to the 2 pi I r over 2 to the n. Here. Right. 2 pi I over 2 to the n over r. The point is this is still some integral root of unity. And it's this thing to the j times b. Okay? And by the usual, so what does this look like, right? If you look in the complex plane, you have some root of unity, and we're taking different multiples of it, right, which will be evenly spread around this. So if you add this up, then I shouldn't put it there. So if you add this up, you're going to get either 0 if these things are really different, or not 1, but some. I guess it's there's actually 2 to the n over r. Okay, so it's 0. And so this is the case when B is a multiple of 2 to the n over R. I should have written these other way, I guess, and 0 otherwise. OK? So these are too small?
Yeah, I can't really read what's in
here. OK. So this sorry, is x of 2 pi I over 2 to the n over R. OK. So omega, remember, was 2 pi I over 2 to the n. And I've just taken this R and stuck it here. And since this is an integer, this is a nice root of unity. And then we can, you know, apply these regular sum type rules to get this. OK? This stuff probably is not too hard. I just may have gone through it poorly. OK? So anyway, the point is, then if you measure, well, we get C 2 to the n over R for some random C. Okay? And with some reasonable probability, we can actually use this to deduce R. OK? So in order to, this is not Shor's algorithm yet. There's a couple pieces we have to do. Well, we have to, first of all, say how to do this modular exponentiation in a reasonable amount of time. We have to say how to do the Fourier transform in a reasonable amount of time. And in the real case, we have to deal with the fact that R does not divide 2 to the n. And the state is not going to be perfectly periodic. OK? And I'll do that tomorrow. OK? But are there questions on what we've done so far? Yeah?
The choice for omega equals the prelimity,
so this one? Yes and no. So what's important is we have to be able to implement the Fourier transform for this specific value of omega. Okay, and 2 to the n is nice because it corresponds to having exactly n qubits here, little n qubits. There's other values of n for which we also know how to implement the Fourier transform efficiently. But I'm not sure it's known for all values of n, all roots of unity, how to do the appropriate Fourier transform in a time that's, you know, polynomial than log of the dimension. Yeah.
Well, in the the sum j equals zero just is down a little bit. The sum directly below it.
Yeah.
If j equals zero, so what's the upper bound on the sum?
Oh, 2 to the n over r minus 1.
Is it like 2 to the n over r minus 1 or 2 to the n over
2
r?
2 to the r n. Minus 1? So yeah, here it's easier to show here, right? It's how many values of j do we need? Well, the whole thing is 2 to the n. And the difference between the spikes is r. So there could be 2 to the n over r of them exactly. So if you're starting with 0, then you could go to 2 to the n over r minus 1. Yeah?
How does measuring c 2 to the n over r give us
r? Well, if c is relatively prime to r, well, OK, first of all, do you see how it gives us c over r? Just divide by 2 to the n. That's easy.
Yeah.
Okay. And then if C is relatively prime over R, relatively prime to R, well, you know the numerator, you know the denominator. So you know R.
Oh, how do we know C, though? I thought it was.
Well, so this is an integer.
Right.
Right? So you know this integer. You divide by 2 to the n and get some rational number. As you pointed out, in this particular case, R has to be a multiple, has to be a power of 2. But in general, we'll have to deal with this issue more carefully. So in this case, R is some power of 2. We want to know which power of 2. So if C is odd, then we have some odd number over some power of 2. And R has to be the power of 2. Now, it could have been that C was actually, say, 2 times an odd number. And then the power of 2 we get is the wrong one. off by one. So that's one of the details that we have to deal with if rows are. So that's the case where C and R are not relatively firm. Okay. But that's something you can handle. You can do it by doing it a couple of times. Okay? So maybe that's it for today, and then we'll finish the first algorithm tomorrow. Hopefully.